It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, advocates for homeless people around the country are trying to build homes, tiny houses, to provide shelter and the basic necessities. We'll hear about a Wisconsin effort after 4:30.
First, we're kicking off a week-long series today that takes stock of Wisconsin's 3 years after the passage of the controversial budget repair bill, otherwise known as Act 10. When Act 10 was introduced in early 2011, it set off a whirlwind of events that put Wisconsin in the center of the national media spotlight. The law, which limited the ability of public workers in Wisconsin to collectively bargain, drew strong praise and strong criticism and created a political climate in the state unlike anything seen before.
Later in the week, we'll talk with two state legislators, one who supports the bill and one of the Wisconsin 14 who left the state in protest of it. We'll also talk with a school superintendent who says Act 10 made his district more efficient and get a labor perspective on the bill as well.
To give us some background on how we got here and to talk about some of the developments in the last couple of years, we've got Jason Stein and Patrick Marley in the studio. Jason and Patrick cover the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and they're the authors of the book More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica.
And Patrick, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me on, Veronica.
So it has been 3 years already since Wisconsin was at the center of the media universe, at least it seemed that way, during the Act 10 battle. And Jason and Patrick, you've covered this story for a long time now. Let's start with you, Patrick. What is the biggest thing that stands out to you about the aftermath of Act 10 3 years down the road?
Well, there's a lot. The biggest thing would be the sort of the reduction of the clout of the unions. Unions for a long time in Wisconsin were a big force in politics. You know, they were the sort of the major player for the outside groups among the Democrats, or one of the most major players, and their ability to sustain that looks substantially diminished because they've lost so much money with the changes to the labor law. Obviously, there are a lot of effects for workers too, in terms of the protections that they had with unions have essentially gone away. Unions continue to exist at the state and local level, but they can only negotiate over wages. They can't bargain over vacation or any other time off, worker safety, those kinds of issues that for decades they had bargained on.
And Jason?
Well, and then as well, there were about $1 billion in cuts that were made to school and local government budgets to help balance a state budget shortfall at the time. And since then, you know, we've gotten information, pretty good information, to show that the strong majority of those cuts to schools were made up by spending cuts that were made possible through Act 10, and those were largely to employees' compensation. A lot of that boils down to lowering employees' take-home pay by reducing their benefits. For local governments, we still have not, and probably will never have, really good data on that, and it kind of boils down to there's not one group or agency that really collects the data from local governments that you need to get a really comprehensive take on that.
Now, lest anyone have forgotten all of the events that happened back in early 2011, let's just take a little bit of a review there. A new governor's in the office. His party controls both chambers of the state legislature. And, Patrick, what happens next?
So the governor was in office for perhaps 30 days, and he introduced this bill that was going to cut the take-home pay of state and local workers by requiring them to pay more for their health care and pay more for their pensions. And then that was to set the stage for cuts to how much the state gave in aid to local governments with the budget that would come just a few months later. And then it also more broadly, as I said before, just reduced the ability of unions to negotiate over a whole host of issues. That the governor's plan was to really dispense with that in a week, get it introduced, have a hearing, have both houses pass it on his desk, signed into law. They anticipated some labor actions from state and local unions. Perhaps they wouldn't show up for work or do some other things. They did not expect these massive protests, and that's exactly what happened, is that tens, perhaps even 100,000 people on some days came to the Capitol and occupied it for a very long period of time. We became, you know, a spotlight nationally. And then just as this was to be taken up by the state Senate, the 14 Democrats who then were in the Senate left the state, went to Illinois, and that triggered an aspect of the state constitution that says you have to have 2/3 of the senators present to pass certain types of bills that deal with money. And they were one vote shy of that by the senators departing. So
three-fifths,
not 2/3. I'm sorry. How could I forget these things?
It's been 3 years.
Yeah. So they were then they were gone for about a month, and the state legislature really ground to a halt. If you also remember, at this time they then tried to send it through the assembly and did, but it took 62 hours of debate over 3 days to get through that house. Eventually, the Senate found a way around the three-fifths issue by changing some aspects of the bill, but not the things that were sort of most important to the protesters, put it through, and the Democrats returned. And then we had a year and a half of recalls.
To put a cap
not
on it.
Not to be
right,
yeah. Right.
Well, the sights and sounds are something that will stick with a lot of people for a long time. And I want to start, we have a little bit of audio from Governor Walker talking about why he thought Act 10 was necessary. Let's listen.
What we're doing is not about being Republican or Democrat. It's about being honest and realistic with the public. We told the people of this state that the two crises we believe we faced were economic and fiscal. I told people all throughout the campaign what I thought the problem was, how I thought I could solve it, and now we're out implementing. And I think the fact that some disagree with it certainly is their right, but we're doing and acting exactly the way we told people we would to tackle these two crises, to get people working again and to get the state budget working again.
Now, a clip there from Governor Walker talking about the reasons behind Act 10. Jason, what goes through your mind as you hear that 3 years later? Does it still sound like something Governor Walker would say today?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think there's an important caveat there that I think during his 2010 campaign, he did talk a lot about the problems with the state budget. He talked about the fact that state employee benefits were part of the problem and needed to be part of the solution. The 2010 campaign was not, however, focused at all on collective bargaining being a problem that also needed to be tackled. It only came up in a few more tangential ways. So he certainly made it clear, I think, in the 2010 campaign that he would take on the issue of employee benefits. But it came as a surprise to many people, including some Republicans, that he took on the collective bargaining issue as well. I think we will see this issue come up in his campaign this year against Democrat Mary Burke. I think we'll see, some assessment, as part of the campaign about how well and in what ways that law is acting. But I don't think it'll be the focus of the campaign. I think the economy of the state will be front and center, has been and will continue to be front and center.
And there was a clip we heard of Governor Walker. Now, as we remember, Act 10 drew tens of thousands of protesters to the Capitol, people who were passionately opposed to Act 10. And here's a clip of sound from that from 3 years back. A little time capsule of the protests there. Patrick, just briefly, what was the scene like then?
Well, it was just unimaginable prior to that to see anything like that. If 2,000 people came to the Capitol, it was a really big deal. When there was the first Tea Party protest, which must have been in 2009, and that was outside the Capitol lawn. It was Governor Doyle at the time. He thought that was a lot of people. We thought that was a lot of people. To see the Capitol just packed wall to wall like a rock concert, where you couldn't get through from one side of the Capitol to the other, was something none of us had ever experienced. And it lasted for essentially a month. I mean, it ebbed and flowed, and there were some times when security was tightened and fewer people were in the Capitol. But really, you had a community there that was, you know, one thing we talk about in our book that was this little detail we came across was that Senator Fred Risser, who's from Madison, his office became a place where women who had babies would go to nurse their children. It became this little place where they could go and seek refuge from the crowds. So you had other places where people were giving out food or handing out water or just giving directions to people. There were posters everywhere, and there were a lot of characters, people dressed up, and it was noisy. And sometimes it smelled like a gymnasium, and there were people banging on drums, and there was nonstop chanting.
We're talking right now with Jason Stein and Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's been 3 years since the passage of Act 10 in Wisconsin, and we're launching a week-long series to talk about the impact of that legislation and what it's done in Wisconsin. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 3 years later, how do you think Act 10 has served Wisconsin, and what will be its lasting impact? We're talking about Act 10 now, 3 years after its passage, and we're launching a week-long series today looking at the impact the laws had. Jason Stein and Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel are with us in studio to get things started, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What do you think the lasting impact of Act 10 on Wisconsin will be? And Jason, let's go to you now. In the passage of Act 10, Wisconsin and Governor Walker were sometimes seen as being at the vanguard of new legislation that had the potential to be used more widely on a national level as a model for other states. Has it had that impact?
Yes, it has. And we certainly were a vanguard. We were a vanguard 50 years ago in Wisconsin when we became the first state to allow union bargaining by public employees at across the state, across the state. And we were in many ways a leader as well in rolling back some of that, a good deal of that authority to bargain on the part of unions. We specifically saw in after Wisconsin, Indiana ended up passing a right-to-work law, which essentially means that unions and employers can't reach an agreement requiring everyone who works for an employer to pay in union dues, which is essentially one of the things that Act 10 did for public sector workers. And then you saw Michigan also pass a right-to-work law.
And if I can just chime in, Ohio is the clearest parallel to Wisconsin. Just after Governor Walker did this, Ohio passed a very similar law to Wisconsin's rolling back collective bargaining for public workers and also going further in some ways because it included police officers and firefighters, which Wisconsin exempted. But unlike Wisconsin, I don't know if they have recalls in Ohio, but they have a voter initiative where you can recall a law, essentially, and the public had an election less than a year after this was passed by the legislature to block it from going into place, and it never actually took effect.
And Patrick, you started by saying one of the things that struck you the most over the last 3 years is that the power of public sector unions has greatly weakened. Is it an overstatement to say that the power of unions in Wisconsin has been broken?
I don't know. I mean, they're still live entities. They're out there. They are doing different kinds of works. I mean, they certainly are operating in a diminished capacity. I guess it's up for the, you know, the unions and their critics to decide whether they've been broken. But certainly they've been substantially weakened.
Jason, you look thoughtful. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, there's certainly you can look just empirically. You can look at the numbers in terms of spending on lobbying. Certain unions like the Wisconsin Education Association Council, which is obviously our state teachers union, was perennially one of the very top, let's say, number one, number two spenders on lobbying at the Capitol. They're no longer anything close to that. Let's say they'd be more like in the 30 to 40 ranking range. I believe at this point, and I wouldn't look for them to crack the top 10, you know, again.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Dale with us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, what do you think?
Hi, Dale.
Hi, I just wanted to correct the record. You know, the reporters, I think, gave a very good summary of what happened, especially going up to Act 10. But I think a key fact that needs to be out there is that Scott Walker never told people his intent to take away worker rights and union rights. And if he would have done that, he never would have been elected. And so I think that's a centerpiece that, when you look at this history, you know, it needs to be clearly out there that he really misled the voters in Wisconsin, and he continues to mislead people when he talks about, you know, what his intentions were.
Patrick, do you want to respond?
Sure. I think Jason talked a little bit about how what the governor, or Scott Walker, who turned out to be governor after 2010, talked about during the campaign, and that's that he did talk about the need, as he saw it, to make workers pay more for their pensions and their health care. And he really talked about that a fair bit, put out news releases, had a press conference about it. He did not, as Dale the caller points out, specifically say, we need to roll back collective bargaining generally and take all these other aspects of union powers and reduce them. And the governor himself acknowledged that. Eventually, you played the clip earlier where he says he thought he conveyed that idea during the campaign. But he did go on to say after Act 10 became law that he wished that he had presented this differently, that he thought the people had given him a mandate to fix the state's problems. He saw the way to do it, and he was going to do it quickly and cleanly, and people would then see the benefits of it. And that looking back, he thinks that he should have done a better job explaining to voters what he saw as the need to be done and how he was going to do it. So I think that addresses the question.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Dale. And Jason, to remember Act 10 is to remember a time when Wisconsin seemed really polarized, very pressurized. There were a lot of rifts created publicly and privately. Has Wisconsin recovered from that yet?
No, that's a great question. I remember at the time, polling by Marquette University showed that I think it was 1 in 5, Patrick, I want to say, people in Wisconsin had stopped talking with someone they knew because it was so, you know, it was so divisive. You know, we did stories about bars that forbade talking about politics because of the disputes it would start, of people that dropped their Facebook friends or criticized their own relatives on Facebook because of disputes over Act 10. And obviously, you know, you had the recalls, which were unprecedented in this state and really historic in terms of our nation's history. Not a lot of – it was only the third gubernatorial recall in the nation's history, first one in which a governor survived. So it certainly was very, very divisive. I would say we are on the way to, you know, repairing some of that division. You know, at this point, there are still live cases in both the state and federal court, right, Patrick?
Correct.
Over Act 10. So I think, you know, it certainly would probably be overstating it to say everything's better, everybody's happy. I mean, because there's ongoing disputes to this day. But we have, I think, there has been at least a scab over the wound. You know, I think that there is some moving on, but it's not total.
And looking ahead to the election season, that scab you talked about, is it going to be ripped off again, or are we going to be just sort of moving forward with something behind us, but moving forward and looking at new issues where Act 10 does not loom so large, Patrick?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we've sort of been in a state of perpetual elections in Wisconsin since 2010, because we did have 9 recalls, I believe, in 2011. And then we had the governor's recall in 2012, as well as the 4 state senators. And now we've got the regular election again. So everybody feels like they've been in nonstop elections. And of course, that's when people feel the most partisan and they see the most TV ads and they get reminded of politics the most. That said, you know, so far, Act 10 has not featured as a prominent player in this election that is only now getting started. But that issue was really sort of litigated in full in the in the recall of 2012. And I think that, you know, Mary Burke, the candidate running against Scott Walker, has talked some about her position on Act 10, but has not made it a centerpiece of her campaign. So I don't know how much we'll be hearing about that.
Yeah, I mean, there will be some. The governor will point and say, look, this worked. You know, his opponents will say it didn't. And Mary Burke has said that she would roll back certain aspects of Act 10. She hasn't said which ones yet. So, I mean, there'll be some discussion, but I don't think it'll be front and center.
All right. Thank you both for being here. Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on.
And Patrick, thank you, too.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jason Stein and Patrick Marley. They cover the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and they're the authors of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. Groups around the country are trying to provide housing for homeless people in the form of tiny houses, very small buildings that provide shelter and the basic necessities.
Olympia, Washington, Austin, Texas, and Eugene, Oregon have small villages of tiny houses, and now there's an effort in Madison to provide them as well. Joining us now is Luca Clementi, a member of Occupy Madison, which is leading the OM Build campaign. Luca, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, can you describe, and you actually call them tiny houses. Can you describe one of them, please?
Well, they are just that. They're 98 square feet houses that are mounted on trailers. They really, for a single person, contain everything you would need to live a very comfortable life, particularly if you've making the transition from homelessness to finally having a place.
And the goal here is to provide some kind of structure, shelter, and the basic needs for homeless people. There are shelters out there. What's the advantage of a tiny house over a homeless shelter?
Well, for one thing, the shelters have a limit as to how many days you can stay in them. So you get 60 days in a shelter per year, but a year has 365 days. So that leaves you, even if you participate fully in using your full time at the shelters, you're going to be on the streets most of the time. And what we wanted to do was create a way for people to facilitate in the construction of their own home. We do not give away tiny homes. We're not a charity organization. What we do is we provide a way for people to participate in the construction of their own home. So they actually get to actually shape the exteriors are very similar, but they actually get to design the interior to fit their specifications.
And you've got the first one up and running now. Somebody's actually living in a tiny house.
That's correct. It's a couple that are living in. Usually they'll be single occupancy, but in this case, it's a couple living in the first one.
Now, I imagine one of the biggest challenges is to find a place to put the house once it's built.
Yeah, especially in Dane County and Madison, it's really not legal to park them anywhere. You have to, we can only have them on the street, and they have to be moved every 48 hours. And it makes it very difficult logistically to keep relocating them, which is why we're trying to take the next step.
And that, let's go on to that next step. What would that be? Where would you find a place to put tiny houses?
Well, we've made an offer that was accepted on a plot of land that's on East Johnson Street, right off of Packers. It's right currently the site of a garage, a repair shop. And we're going to convert that if everything goes well. Our intent is to make that into a combination workshop and residential area.
And so from the perspective of a person with no home right now, if they wanted to stay in a tiny house, how would they get on board?
Well, you could start by coming to one of our meetings, and we have those every month. The website is OccupyMadisonInc.com. The word on the street is out. I mean, people at Bethel communicate regularly as to how to get involved. So anybody who wants to come to the shop or get involved should have no difficulty.
And is this a thing where you're going to try to work with the city on this to try to get them on board with things like zoning and inspections and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that is the real difficulty, the zoning, because right now nobody really knows. We're doing something quite new and nobody really knows what to call this. For a while, the state was going to define us as a campground, but they've since, to my understanding, decided not to do that. And so now we really don't know what we are. They're considering this a mixed-use development. And the zoning is, of course, very unusual. So we're working with the city right now to get this developed and implemented, because it's never been done before.
How big is the need for some kind of shelter for homeless people, like a place they can call their own as opposed to the shelters that we talked about earlier?
Well, it's huge. Madison has a very large homeless problem. And there are a lot of services that do help. There are all sorts of organizations that help to feed and provide shelter for homeless people in Madison. But at the end of the day, you still have no place to call your own. You still have nowhere really to keep your possessions. You don't have the security and dignity that comes with having a place of your own to live.
I mean, that's something I think about. Like, where do you keep your stuff? And that's one of the problems you're trying to answer here.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to even attempt to go to a job interview when you haven't had a shower and you're carrying all your possessions on your back. And so that's one of the things that having a house that we take for granted that is so important.
I mentioned a few of the cities around the country that already have programs like this in place. Is your group in Madison looking to them for ideas and practical advice? And in turn, are people maybe elsewhere in the state or in the region coming to you to see how it's going for you?
Yeah, there is communication. A few of us actually went on kind of a fact-finding trip a few months back and did a tour of these other places, and we saw what made them work and what their strengths were and where we thought we might be able to actually improve upon their model.
Talking to the people at those sites are your first couple in the first Madison tiny house. So what are they saying about it, about the experience of moving in?
Well, right now, since this, you know, they're sort of in the prototype. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're telling us, you know, what's working and what isn't. And for the most part, they've been very comfortable and things are much better than not having any place to stay. But when you're talking about 98 square feet, it's very important that it's very intelligently designed or it's going to end up being something that is not going to work for the people in it. So they're giving us feedback and we're continuing to work with modifying it.
And then who's building it? You said the people who are going to live there take part in the building, but obviously not everybody has the skills. I certainly wouldn't to build a structure from top to bottom, even a small one.
Well, there are enough of us involved in Occupy Madison and OM Build that have the skills that are able to help share those skills with the people who don't. And so not having the knowledge of how to construct a house is not any obstacle. Just come on down. You can sign up for a shift. We work with people, and before long, you'll have all the skills you need.
You mentioned working with the city. How about working with neighbors at a site? Not every homeowner or renter is going to be excited at the idea of honestly having homeless people move into structures right next door.
That's true. We tried to proactively schedule meetings with our alder, Larry Palm, in the neighborhood, and we ended up having a series of meetings where people were allowed to, given the opportunity to talk about some of their concerns. And then we went back and had meetings about how to address those concerns. And some of our policies were actually modified somewhat to help assuage the concerns of the neighbors.
Are you hearing about other communities in Wisconsin, maybe Milwaukee or other cities, trying to follow your lead here?
Not yet. But this is still, you know, everybody's just sort of waiting to see how this happens. There are a lot of people who are just sort of on the fence, and I imagine if this is viable, we'll begin to get a lot more active questions from communities all around the country, actually.
So the houses themselves, you've been inside the
yes.
prototype, I imagine. This is not a luxury house, 9 by 10, about, you said, 99 square feet, right? What's it like to think about spending your time there?
Well, you'd be surprised how comfortable it is. I mean, one of the things that was really important to us in the design of these houses was not only to make them functional. I mean, they have the electricity. They also have heat. I mean, we have a heating and air conditioning guy who calculated the thermal loss and made sure that they'd be able to stay warm in the winter. And one of the things that's really important, though, aside from practical considerations, is the aesthetic considerations. It was really important that these be beautiful, because people are going to be spending time in them. We wanted to instill sort of the pride of ownership and a real connectedness to the project. It's easy to think of how we might do the project cheaper by, you know, warehousing far greater numbers of people in much cheaper, like, tin shed structures, but that was not what we were going for. We wanted every one of these to be a unique, beautiful home.
And the philosophy isn't we are warehousing homeless people, I guess.
Definitely not. I mean, one of the objections that we have come across is that, well, we like your idea, but, you know, you should do this out by the airport or in some remote location. And what we would like to do is actually, this is a model we want to integrate into communities. The idea is not to put people in isolated areas where all the problems, you know, isolation and addiction and crime, those kinds of things fester in isolation. We want to be active participants in the community. So we expect to be going to neighborhood meetings to participate in keeping the neighborhood clean. And again, we want to beautify it. We're not there to create some sort of a shanty town.
You're at an early stage here. Do you have a sense of how many of these small houses you are going to be able to provide down the road, or a goal, a target?
As long as we can keep building them, we want to keep building them. But it does raise the practical question of where to put them. And so that will be an ongoing issue that we will deal with as we go.
Luca, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Luca Clementi with Occupy Madison telling us about the group's effort to provide what they're calling tiny houses to homeless people in the area. It's time for Wisconsin Life. March is Women's History Month. Schools are part of the landscape today, but they only came into existence in early Wisconsin once a critical mass of parents was willing to hire a teacher. Wisconsin got its first public school teacher in the 1820s. Writer Karen Sayman tells us about this well-educated woman from the Stockbridge Indian tribe.
Electa Quinney is a Stockbridge Indian, born around 1807 in the state of New York. And she was born to really the most prominent family in Stockbridge tribal history. Her father, her grandfather, ultimately her brothers were all tribal chiefs. At about age 7, Electa was sent to boarding school. And these were not the BIA boarding schools of years later. She went to a couple of boarding schools in New York that were girls' finishing schools. The best white families up and down the East Coast sent their daughters to these schools. Young women at that time really didn't go to college. The colleges just weren't open to them. So this was really about as high as you could go in terms of education. Went on to become a teacher, taught for 6 years in New York, and then the Stockbridge Indians were pushed out of New York. They saw the writing on the wall. They were a very well-educated, very savvy tribe, and negotiated a deal with the Menominee Indians to come to Wisconsin. So she came here, arrived here on June 20th, 1828. She was the very first public school teacher in Wisconsin. So when she arrived here, she was about 21 years old, taught at a school in a place called Statesburg, which today is Kaukauna, and taught Stockbridge children and the children of white missionaries who had come out here with her. It was a mission school. But the teachers there were paid by the public funds of the Indians. This is distinguished from other schools that had been here in Wisconsin prior to that. You had families who had hired private tutors. You had some private schools that were run by churches. You had a handful of children who were here with fathers who were stationed at military forts. The U.S. military had a handful of schools up until then. And she taught math, geography, history, spelling. It was a Christian school, so she started each day with a prayer. But it was a little one-room schoolhouse, multi-educational schoolhouse, everybody in one room, sitting right on the Fox River. We have one student of hers who actually wrote down his memories years later and said that it was modeled after the best public schools of New England, which was quite a compliment. That we had a highly educated, highly intelligent Indian woman who was our first public school teacher here in Wisconsin. That, of course, is the most important thing, to recognize that accomplishment.
Karen Sayman is a journalist and author of Electa Quinney, Stockbridge Teacher. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now, in honor of Women's History Month, Erica Janik joins us in studio to talk about women who hold key places in the pages of Wisconsin history. Erica, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dive into the actual women themselves of Wisconsin history, let's start with the state constitution, 1848, a key year. What happened?
Well, actually, so 1848 is the year that Wisconsin became a state. And the constitution that we adopted that became, you know, the law of our land was actually our second constitution. We'd actually had a first draft in 1846 that was a little too radical. And one of the very radical provisions it included was that married women could own property. Now, in pretty much every other state, women were property. They couldn't own property. So this was pretty far out there for the time. And unfortunately, this constitution, along with a couple other pretty radical provisions in it, were thrown aside, and they rewrote a new constitution that did not have married women's property rights in it.
But eventually, it made the cut a couple years later.
Eventually, yes. You do find that women are gaining more rights in the late 19th century, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. But, you know, it definitely wasn't written into our founding documents, despite some efforts to make that happen.
And there's a bit of interesting history we were talking about this morning as we were talking about beer and the possible Wisconsin Beer Commission. There's a crossover between beer and women's rights in Wisconsin.
That's right. The brewing industry was a major power in early Wisconsin. And as, you know, evidenced by this possibility of us becoming this kind of brewing center of the world. But the brewers were really kind of against women's rights. And they had kind of a good reason for thinking this. They thought that if women were given the vote, that they would vote for temperance. And they were probably right. Throughout the 19th century, women were the leading advocates for temperance. And one of the reasons that they were doing it is because a lot of their families were really ruined by men's alcoholism. And so women thought that they just needed to get rid of alcohol. And so the brewers, that would have really, you know, put them out of business. And so they were not in favor of giving women the right to vote.
And were they influential?
They were very influential. They were some of the leading citizens of our state. Think about like Frederick Pabst, a very leading figure in Wisconsin. There was a lot of money that was coming into the state from the brewing industry. So it was in the best interest for some people to think that they needed to support the brewers' position on this. And Wisconsin actually had a suffrage referendum in 1912, and the brewers were pretty much instrumental in helping to get that defeated.
Interesting. But eventually the tides of history turned, of course, and not a key issue with brewers anymore. Thank heavens.
As far as I know, I don't think they're still against women's rights.
Well, let's dig into some of the women because there's so many fascinating stories here. I want to start with one, a Ho-Chunk leader called Glory of the Morning. Can you tell us about her?
So Glory of the Morning is actually the first woman we have a written record of. And she was mentioned in an account that was written by a British soldier. His name was Jonathan Carver, and he was traveling through Wisconsin in the 1760s. And in traveling through the state, he ran across a female chief right around where Nina is today. And she was the last known Ho-Chunk female chief. Glory of the Morning was chosen to lead her people when she was about 18 years old in 1727. She eventually married a French officer who resigned his commission after the marriage and became a fur trader. They had three children together. Eventually, he ended up abandoning her. But the family remained very prominent in Wisconsin. They became the French, kind of an anglicization, get that word out there, of the French last name that she had through her marriage became DeCora. And the DeCora family you find all throughout 18th century and 19th century Wisconsin, a very prominent family. And Glory of the Morning's two sons also became Ho-Chunk chiefs.
Oh, fascinating. And, well, there's another key leader let's move to now that you want us to know about, a woman who revolutionized the care for Union troops wounded in the Civil War. Her name was Cordelia Harvey. What do we know about her?
So Cordelia Harvey, she was actually married to a Wisconsin governor. His name was Lewis P. Harvey. He became governor of Wisconsin in 1861 when the Civil War broke out. Now, he kind of tragically died. He was traveling through the South to visit some Wisconsin troops, and he ended up kind of tripping and ended up drowning. And she was, you know, obviously very heartbroken over the loss of her husband, but it didn't really deter her in her work and trying to improve the conditions for Union soldiers. She went all over the South, visiting Wisconsin troops and military hospitals. She was actually appointed our state sanitary agent. That was really referring to people that were kind of looking after hospitals and seeing how well, you know, hygiene and cleanliness were in some of these military installations. She actually became convinced through her travels throughout the South that hot, wet climate was actually bad for people's health, that it was impairing their ability to get better, and that these soldiers should actually be brought back north in order to feel better. So she traveled all the way to Washington, D.C., where she met with President Abraham Lincoln and said, "We need a hospital in the North to care for Union soldiers." And he was kind of skeptical of her idea, not really sure that was the best thing to do. But he did eventually authorize what came to be called the Harvey Army Hospital here in Madison, named after Cordelia and her husband. And the hospital was very, very successful. And after the war, it actually morphed into a home for orphan children, because in the Civil War, about 500,000 men were killed. And so a lot of families lost their means of support. And so I think it's something like 700 children eventually lived in that home in the decade after the war.
So she was state sanitary agent for Wisconsin troops, an unusual title. I'm pretty sure that we don't have one of those now.
Pretty sure we don't.
But I'm curious, were there other women like her in other states, or was she something of an outlier who was doing remarkable things for a woman at the time?
There were definitely other sanitary commissions all throughout the country. That's a pretty common thing during the Civil War. But I think she is really a remarkable woman in the fact that she was so determined to get this hospital built, that she was willing to travel all the way to D.C. to meet with the president. He was unwilling to meet with her at first, thought this was kind of a silly idea. Why should he be paying attention to her? But she persisted. She would not give up. She knew that she was right. And she eventually, you know, managed to convince Abraham Lincoln that we needed to have this hospital, and she got it built. I mean, this happened here in Madison and was very, very successful. So I think, you know, she's definitely one of a kind.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's look at Theodora Winton Eumanns. She made a mark as a journalist in Wisconsin and went on to become a leader nationally as well. How did she get her start?
So she actually began as a journalist for the Waukesha Freeman newspaper. She wrote a column that was about women's political issues. And the column became so popular that it was actually the only column in that whole newspaper that had a byline. So newspaper articles in the past often didn't have the author's name there. But Eumanns had her name on her column. And so she eventually becomes a leader in Waukesha Women's Clubs. She becomes president of the Wisconsin Federation of Women's Clubs in 1898. She's really active in all of these kind of political organizations, volunteer organizations. In the 1910s, she really becomes very active in the suffrage movement. She uses her journalism experience and connections to really publicize the cause of women's rights, to try to, you know, be louder than the voice of the brewers, and to win endorsements of groups like the German Turners, a group that hadn't traditionally supported women's suffrage, but she really used her persuasive skills to get people on board for suffrage. Then she became very active on the national level. She was very instrumental in helping to get the Wisconsin to become the first state to actually ratify the suffrage amendment. It was a kind of an arms race with Illinois, but Wisconsin won. And after that, Eumanns served as president of the Wisconsin chapter of the League of Women Voters, which is another organization founded by a Wisconsin woman, Carrie Chapman Catt. So Wisconsin has played a very leading role, our women on the national level, doing really phenomenal things.
Erica, it's fantastic to hear about this. I'm sure there's so much more you could tell us, but thank you for telling us about these women and introducing us to them.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Erica Janik, the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous and the producer of Wisconsin Life.